Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Well, if you strike a corner rose, keep going. If it hails or if it snows, keep going. Ain't no use to sit and whine when the fish ain't on your line. Bait your hook, keep it trying and keep going. When the weather kills your crop, keep going.
Keep going.
Though it's work to reach the top, just keep going.
Keep going.
Expose your eye to every dime. Hey, getting broke ain't any crime. Tell the world you're feeling fine and keep going.
Keep going.
Keep going.
Keep going.
Keep going. Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to 2018. What do you think so far? Isn't this just such an amazing time to be alive? You know, I go on the social media sites and I just see so many posts from people who are like, ooh, I don't like the world. You know what, face? Maybe you should watch more dystopian sci-fi from the 80s. That's what I always say to these people. Folks, we are currently living in the era of the 1987 Arnold Schwarzenegger film, The Running Man, which took place between 2017 and 2019. Check a calendar. That is right now. And also the later Terminator movies, Genesis and Salvation, took place in 2017 and 2018, respectively. I'd say comparatively we're doing pretty well, even though I certainly hope I don't have to eat those words this coming year. Especially in the case of that Terminator movie. Oh, could you imagine that, being chased around all over the place by a bunch of robots that are programmed to kill you? But let's keep that in mind, how things could have gone. When we think about the vision of the future, the vision of our right now, that some very smart people had in the 1980s, we're getting off pretty easy.
Yeah, but YouTube demonetized my channel.
Okay, well, how about instead of you having a YouTube channel, you're just on a television show where a guy chases you through a labyrinth with a chainsaw. And you know what? The people watching the show, they don't even think you're the protagonist. They're rooting for the guy with the chainsaw. So yeah, I'd just like to remind everybody about gratitude, and I wanted to wish you all good fortune in the new year. On the show today, we are in the home stretch of School Sucks across America. This is day 37, Knoxville, Tennessee. I want to thank, huge thanks, to a listener named Carrie, who organized this small meetup on very short notice. About a week before, I had made some adjustments to the return trip to cut a faster and more direct route back to New Hampshire, and Carrie was able to organize for me a meeting with two Knoxville radio hosts. Actually, Daniel is the producer of the show, and Sherry is one of the hosts. The show is called Speaking Freely, and both Daniel and Sherry have each participated in some form of home education for their children, so that makes up a big part of our discussion. Coming up in the next 7 days, the final meetup from the tour in Richmond, Virginia. Nice group of guys there. That was a lot of fun. And then the concluding episode from School Sucks Across America, day 40 with Richard Grove and Nick Ulbrich. I'm working on some exciting guests to get us started here in 2018, so please stay tuned. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
Keep a going.
Keep a going.
Now keep a going.
Keep a going.
Oh, keep a going.
Expose you out of every dime, now getting broken any crime. Tell the world you're feeling fine. Keep a going. Oh, keep it going.
Keep it going.
Knoxville, School Sucks Across America, 20th of November, 2017. Meet up for Kerry, Sherry, and Daniel. Take one.
That doesn't mean we have to go, okay, now this is the serious time. I do want to say that I appreciate you guys coming out, and I appreciate you putting this together very much. How did you guys all connect originally?
So
Facebook.
Yeah. My plan was to go see you in Atlanta when you came through. So yeah, so I basically put out feelers to all the people that I know, which isn't very many anymore because I haven't really been involved with the libertarian scene for a couple of years. But Josh Eagle was one of the people, and he does a radio show with Sherry, and Daniel produces that show. And so I was like, hey, do you guys want to come see this thing? And sent them your website, and they said, okay. So yeah, so here they are.
What was attractive to you about the website?
We both have been homeschooling our kids separately.
Yeah.
For years. I came along because I thought it would be interesting. I guess Sherry actually did research.
So Sherry, you looked at the website?
I did. Very good website, by the way.
Thank you.
A lot of websites I go to are horrible to navigate and find what you need.
Well, they look like they're made by crazy people.
Yes.
And they
are. The information doesn't make sense as to where you should look, but it was very well laid out. A lot of good information. And I did listen to a few podcasts.
Oh, cool.
Very good. I enjoyed it very much. So I'll probably start listening.
Can I ask what you listened to?
I listened to the one about, it had Alex Jones on the front of it.
Oh, no.
And about...
The echo chamber wall just got 20
yes,
feet higher?
Yes, just got 20 feet higher. Yes, right, that was okay. It. That's the one I listened to. Yeah, it was done really well.
Can I ask what you'd be trying to, as, you know, a libertarian and an unschooling parent, what would you be trying to extract from a website like that, ideally? Like, what would make it worth your time?
Information on how to go about unschooling, probably. And I noticed you had some classes, some pod classes on there.
Yeah,
I didn't
get
to check them out, but... just things like that and the politics of what's going on around homeschooling, because Knoxville is very homeschool friendly, but a lot of places aren't. And I know I've met a lot of people who are moving to Knoxville just because it's so difficult to homeschool where they are. So
from other parts of the state or just
other parts of the country. Even.
Yeah. 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 So I asked because you have a 14-year-old, right? Who used to go to school. And now he's doing primarily the Ron Paul curriculum.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, eventually I want to build my site out as a hub and a resource. I mean, it is that to a certain extent. It needs to be a little bit better organized. But we do have these pod classes that are series of shows that were originally, I mean, I started doing the show 8 years ago wanting to talk to teens. Like, if I was 16 years old, what would I want to hear the person at the front of the room? If they were honest, what would they say? You know, so having been a teacher and worked with kids that age, that was what I was trying to create. So a lot of those series, I think, are very accessible for that age group, the teenage, you know, especially if he's been out of school for a while and he's doing his own thing. He's got confidence and self-direction in what he's doing. So how's the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum? You said you've been using that for him?
Yes. I really like it. It really encourages them, the kids, to be independent and to go to the forums. So the older kids are encouraged to be on the forums and answer questions for younger kids. And then if they can't get an answer there, to talk with the teacher that made the class and then to ask parents. So it's really, they're supposed to seek out their own answers. I really like how, I think it was last year's English was understanding or literature, analyzing literature. So they're already kind of incorporating these college level ideas with them in the eighth grade, ninth grade, getting them ready for college so that they can take CLIP exams, get right into what they want to do if they decide to go to college and get through it quickly.
How complete is the curriculum? Is it like all subjects?
Yes. It's the basics. And then they have, he took a personal finance course, which probably was the best thing he took all last year.
So you can pick and choose a little bit?
Yes.
Okay.
So we go by the state standards, of course, of what we, in Tennessee, we have an umbrella school system. So you can register straight with the county, but I choose not to do that because I don't want the government that close to me. So I go through like a buffer system with a private school that acts as an umbrella for me, and they have their standard and they follow the state standard, and they deal with all the government stuff, making sure that my grades are turned in and my attendance.
And they're sympathetic to the way you want education to work.
Absolutely.
With your family. Right. Yeah. And some states are really hands-off about it. Like New Hampshire, I was in a role like that where I was basically the umbrella for a family as a just a private service provider. And they were like, hey, you know, as long as he's not in the school causing trouble. I mean, basically, that was the impression that I got of their level of interest. But I know some states are really, really strict about it. So you have the one child who you took out of school after fourth grade, and then you have a younger child who's never been to school as a result of those lessons, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, 7-year-old girl.
So we'll come back to that. I wanted to hear your story, Daniel. Yes.
So we've homeschooled in Alaska, Pennsylvania, and now here. And then my parents, my dad and my stepmom have homeschooled in North Carolina. And of all those, North Carolina was the most restrictive. Mm-hmm. And then Tennessee. In Alaska, they actually subsidize you doing whatever you want to do. They have charter schools that exist as a way to get state money to students to buy you materials and to pay for anything you might want, up to a limit of about $8,000 per student per year. Mm-hmm. Because of the nature of rural Alaska, is in order to meet the mandate that they have to educate all of the people, it's way easier for them, if you're not in a major city, to do it through homeschooling. And so they extend that to everybody.
Right.
So they bought us scientific equipment. They paid for skating lessons. They did everything. And there was no real oversight. But we weren't yet unschoolers there. In Pennsylvania, you submit your materials to the state.
Mm-hmm.
But you get an evaluator, and it's entirely up to the evaluator as to whether or not you're meeting your standards. So we found an unschooling-friendly evaluator who was like, your kids are great. Mm-hmm. You pass. And, you know, as long as you have a certified evaluator, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
The state has all of these requirements. The school board will act like they can say no. But legally, they're not allowed to say no. So they'll push back, and you just ignore them. And then you go back to your evaluator, and you go, am I okay? And they say yes. And then you just submit, and you go, my evaluator said I'm fine. So I'm going back to what I was doing.
So where do the evaluators come from?
My wife handles more of that than I do, but my understanding is they have an education background, but I don't know what it takes to be certified as an evaluator.
I gotcha. So you said we weren't yet unschooling. How did you make the transition from what we call homeschooling to more of what we call unschooling?
My wife is tries to stay up to date. And when we found out that my son has Asperger's, she was looking for more flexible systems because he was not really capable of following a curriculum, but he's brilliant. And so we knew that we had to be able to accept that. And then my other children, I've got 4 children who are all homeschooled.
Mm-hmm.
And so my youngest has never had a curriculum. She's never had a formal lesson.
How old?
11.
Mm-hmm.
And she just took the state testing for Pennsylvania right before we left a few months ago. And her worst subject was a grade level above, and that was reading. And her best subject, no, that was math, and her best subject was reading, and she was a freshman in college level. Having never been taught to read, having never been given a math class, really playing Minecraft, interacting with people, and being inspired to figure it out via YouTube and asking questions, she basically has managed to get herself above grade level in every subject, including the one she hates and doesn't do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So your son with Asperger's, he's the oldest?
Yes.
Okay.
He's 20 now.
So is it what started with him and then sort of immediately went to your other children as well? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So we never planned on putting our children in school because of all the problems in public school and involving socialization and having kids learn how to deal with other people from kids their age who don't know and dealing with what amounts to a formalized prison structure for children.
Sure.
So we never wanted to do that. And then I had the example of my dad and my stepmom who were educating my half siblings at home. They were doing more of a Christian curriculum, which we weren't particularly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But so we started out on a curriculum for the older two. But just as it became more evident that, you know, kind of a Montessori unschooling, you know, we just moved more in that direction, mostly because the kids just naturally gravitated that way anyway. And moving around like we did and just having the opportunities we did, we figured out that they learned better from living their lives than they did from sitting down and trying to force them to do stuff they weren't yet wanting to do.
Right. Were you nervous about it at first?
I was freaked out. Like, yeah. Susanna, my wife, was way better at, like, at least not showing it.
Yeah.
I was concerned. Like, I wanted the kids to be on a math curriculum and all this other stuff that we started out with. And it wasn't until my daughter, my older daughter, went to her freshman year of college, or freshman year of high school, and enrolled because she wanted the social aspect. She wanted to give high school a try.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I hear that a lot.
And so they put her, they started her out in remedial classes because they didn't know where she belonged.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, maxed out all the testing, and they finally were like, okay, we'll put you in standard academic classes. And she was there for about a day, and then they moved her up to the honors classes. And at each stage, teaching got worse.
Because, yeah.
Because they have to teach to the test. And so they have to bring they have to put all their effort in getting the slowest kids, or the kids with the most challenges, up to grade level.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids that are really smart, they don't even try to teach them.
They're on autopilot.
Right. They're like, these kids will pass the test no matter what we do. So we can't expend any effort in that direction.
So what were her complaints about what was going on in these classes?
That she would show initiative because she's a very self-motivated kid. Uh-huh. I mean, she decided to go to school. And so she would show motivation and she would show initiative and she would get penalized for it because it wasn't what was coming out of the textbook or it wasn't what was going to be on the test.
And they're foot-binding them, basically.
Right. So, so she was being, and so they would put her in group projects with the three slowest kids in the class.
Mm-hmm.
And she would have to, get them up to speed, and then they would move her to the next group. And so she was spent her whole time in mud. She was never learning anything. She was basically doing the teaching for the classes.
Did you find that it affected her attitude towards learning in general? Having had that experience, outside of school, developing that kind of confidence as a learner, but also that perspective, your kids saw the vista, they saw that education is this panorama, and it's okay if they have to go in the tube once they know that. It sucks if you have to go in the tube at the beginning and you never get to see and now it's getting even harder not to see it. Kids know that information is everywhere and learning is everywhere. I didn't know that, So yeah. She happy? Was she happy there?
So she was not happy there. We were in a small town in rural Pennsylvania.
Right.
And they were they didn't know how to handle overachieving kids.
Right.
They knew how to handle kids that were going to be farmers, and they knew how to handle kids that were going to work in a plant. They didn't so much know how to handle kids that were considering Princeton.
Right.
So she enjoyed some of it, but what she mostly enjoyed was that she was the feeling that she was that she had accomplished more than anybody there was ever going to in her perspective.
Right.
Like, she wasn't learning anything there. She was just there to play on the soccer team, to be in the choir, to go to Model UN. And so she did all of those things she could do in 2 years. And then she's like, okay, I'm ready to go back to unschool. And so she stepped back away. She kept playing soccer because in Pennsylvania, you're allowed to participate in school sports.
Yep. Yeah.
But other than that, she completely stepped back away from public school.
Yeah. So when I was talking, let's just go right around and get answers from everybody. When I was talking about that idea of the tube versus the panorama, and we're all probably the same generation, I would guess. In New Hampshire, I talked to a lot of libertarians, and they said, I was always an anarchist. I always knew I was smarter. Like they say things like that. And I go, I didn't. I thought I was an idiot because that was the only metric I had in the world to tell me what my intellectual worth or contribution could be. And, the first 6 years were great. I think we all got all A's. But then, when I got to middle school, I think I was 13, it just dawned on me one day, how long is this going to go on? This has been half my life, and you don't have any perspective. Like, now it seems like a fairly small part of my life, but then it was my whole life.
Yeah.
And I had very little outside of school that could have told me I actually had talent or ability because I was bored in school and I didn't get good grades. And my teachers told me about it and my parents told me about it and I internalized it and just didn't think I was that bright or capable. I just wanted to hear your experiences on that, because I think, you know, that's probably, people always want me to qualify. How long did you teach? How many kids have you worked with? What kind of tutoring have you done? I was like, look, I was a public school student for 15,000 hours of my life, and I do have a resume, but I think that's what qualifies me, is this experience that I had to comment on it. So I just wanted to hear each of your thoughts.
I guess I was a people pleaser. I was a singer from a very young age. So I had talent. I'm putting those in air quotes. That got me through a lot of stuff. School was always very easy for me. I could just go do whatever they said to do. I would get straight A's. That probably got me through, gosh, all the way probably to high school, I think. Now, I was in Christian school from kindergarten through, I think, sixth grade. And then I went to public school in sixth grade. But then in high school, I think I started, I had interests that were, you know, music, theater, all of that. And I was much more interested in doing those things. So everything else was just kind of like, what do I have to do to get through the day so I can go to the choir rehearsal or the drama rehearsal or the whatever? Like, what's the minimum I can do to get by? Right. So did that, got an honors diploma from that.
But you felt like you had a reason for being there then, right? Like you had to kind of trudge through this other stuff, but there was a purpose.
There was always a purpose. I always knew, oh, I have to go to college. But then when I got out of, when I graduated, my first major that I wanted to do was musical theater. But I, my mother told me that I wasn't responsible enough to do that, to go out of state, to go to college for musical theater. So I needed to kind of stick around. So I did that and I majored in music. Then I switched to theater. Then I switched to business. Then I dropped out. I worked for a television station. I worked for a theater. I went back to school. I was back and forth in school. I didn't actually graduate with a degree until 2014. I graduated high school in 1994. So it was like that. But I knew there was like something in the back of my mind. Oh, I have to get that degree. I have to get it. I have to get it. If I don't get it, I will never be good enough or whatever. Turns out, the degree that I have is in graphic design, which I got online. The job that I currently have as a graphic designer, I started right about the same time. I still have that job. I now have a degree. I could have Googled everything in the degree. So, yeah, that's where I am.
So, and you also said that you were, like, attracted to the work of the Praxis guys, Isaac, Zach. Because but that is basically like is. Similar to what they're driving at, right? Like the better credential than this ridiculous monster that's been created called the $100,000, $200,000 4-year college degree. You know,
had I been able to apprentice, say, at a theater, which is what I wanted to do when I graduated high school, had I been able to do that right out of high school, I probably would still be doing theater now, you know? I mean, I probably would have like shot through the ranks because I was really, really interested in it, but I got beaten down so much from, and everybody saying you have to have a fallback. You have to have something to fall back on. You're never going to make it as a singer and actress. So you have to do something else to fall back on. And it's kind of just pounded into your brain to where you're just like, okay, I guess I'll just kind of do this on the side. This is just kind of a side project for me. And then where does the time go after that?
That is a tough one to answer because it seems that there's this cliche to say everyone should follow their passions. And then the, you know, the economy would just completely collapse if I snapped my fingers and everybody followed their passions, right? Or if they had to like say, all right, it's time to get serious, time to figure out what my passion is and start pursuing it, right? There would just be fires and looting everywhere if that happened, you know? I mean, we would be in serious trouble. The function of school, and this is one of the really difficult things to wrestle with, is to standardize people and turn them into employees and people who will fit themselves into the machinery of commerce and the machinery of society so society can survive. It's always been the purpose. You know, kids are getting frustrated with school now because of like these weird, you know, math formulas they have, like the Common Core.
Yeah.
Right? Common Core is about producing workers for the service economy because that's the future of American employment, you know? So, yeah.
So one of the more interesting talks I've ever read or heard was the supposition that school doesn't actually teach you to prepare you for today's jobs.
Right.
What it prepares you for is an 18th century Victorian bureaucrat where England can put you anywhere in the world where you can run the Foreign Office. And that's because we're based, the American school system is derived almost entirely from the English school system.
And which is Prussian.
Right. Yeah. And that entire process was just designed to be able to plug people in so that everybody is replaceable.
Mm-hmm.
Where we live now is where nobody's replaceable. Everybody's got to find their own way. And so we're actually actively teaching people to be unprepared for the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
Because people who come out of the school system are not adaptable. They're not able to figure out. They're only able to regurgitate information.
Right. And unadaptable people, like that unadaptability was a job skill.
Right.
Right? You can stand here and do this thing all day. Well, we don't know how you do it, but good. We can use 1,000 people just like you. Who, you know, never seem to get bored or never complain about being bored doing this one thing. Mm. And you could have a job for, and I'm not to, you know, demeaning that kind of work, but I'm just saying that the kinds of jobs that existed in 1875 are completely non-existent
right.
today,
yeah.
You know, and that was maybe a growing pain in the American economy where people just had to train themselves to stand still and be, you know, immersed in excruciating boredom. That doesn't exist anymore. Now, there was still this kind of unadaptability that was necessary for many corporate jobs and many areas of the economy where you're going to do the same thing all the time. And you're going to have this job from the time you're 25 until you retire. That was very common. I mean, my parents, if they wanted to, their generation, you know, could have logged 35 or 40 years in the same company, maybe even the same job, just kind of notching up a few times. Teachers do it, right? But that doesn't, but we're changing jobs now. My generation, every 3 years, every 4 years. I mean, I've changed. I would just, you know, go from one teaching or tutoring or consulting thing, and in a couple of years, I would have a problem with it. I'd be like, I'm not part of the solution, or I'm bored, or I don't enjoy this, or it's repetitive, and I need to do the next thing. And I think more of us are like that. I think that the stimulation we encounter from the outside contributes to that, but also the economy is a part of that. It's much more fluid than it used to be. So, yeah, I think that there is that problem that kids are not self-sufficient or self-directed, right? Who are we talking about? Sherry, you said you had friends who were teachers and they were just kind of marching the kids. Same thing is happening with your daughter, Daniel. They're just marching the kids through these steps and they get to the end and they say, okay, who tells me what to do next? I mean, I remember getting to college at 18 years old in 1995. And I just went bananas. You know, I can drink every night. I can eat whatever I want. You know, I can go to class. I can not go to class. Nothing had prepared me for that kind of independence. And I was an adult.
Ready for real world consequences.
Yeah.
You know, by your age,
yeah.
Just aging up to that, but not really prepared for them. Like, people don't prepare their kids for that next. Like, I always try to keep in mind that I'm raising adults. I'm not raising children.
Mm.
So even now, you know, I love my children, but they're not the center of my life. Sometimes they'll want me to do something. No, sorry, mommy's doing something else. Like this, that's yours to take care of. You can make yourself the sandwich. You don't need me to do that because I want them to be independent and be able to do those things for themselves. And
right.
So I just don't put everything I'm doing aside all the time for them. Like I do things for them, but I have my own life and I want them to see that it's okay for you to have your own life and you should be doing the things that you need to do. And not me over the top of you all the time telling you what to do. It's like the difference between building drive in a child. Like the child who's driven, say, you know, a lot of kids ask for like a horse or something. They want a horse. They really want it. So there's a difference between desire and drive. So they have this desire for something and you give it to them and then they don't take care of it, like a dog or something.
Right, right.
But then if they're driven, they figure out how to get to the horse and they figure out how to make it so they can get there and take care of it and what they need to do. And you're not doing that for them. You may just be facilitating it, but you're letting them build that responsibility on their own. So
right.
I try to do that for my kids as much as possible. So.
What was school like for you?
Horrendous.
Yeah.
I pretty much, there were times there were bright spots in my schooling, but for the most part, it was always like torture in a lot of ways. When I was young, my parents were going through a divorce in my early schooling, and I come from a really, really impoverished background and a really abusive background. So it took years coming out of that. Like, even after my parents divorced, there was still just a lot of issues. So it was always sort of like this thing I had to do that I didn't really want to be there. I didn't care about it. I remember my junior year in high school, I should have failed because I wasn't at school enough. Like, mm-hmm. I just wouldn't go. And I told the vice principal that I had some religion that, you know, we didn't go to the doctor. So he signed something. I don't know what it was. And I went on to the 12th grade, but I was passed, you know, I was just like barely passed enough to get to the next grade. And then like my senior year, I engaged a little bit more, and I had to take an extra class in summer school to graduate, but I did. But it was always, it was like, I don't know, a lot of it was abusive, I felt, in school. Like, a lot of some of the other kids, I was bullied a lot as a child, and then in high school there were some issues, and so it was more like a somewhere to just endure. I was in ROTC, which I really loved at the time, and I was planning on going into the military, and that was really probably one of the only things that kept me from dropping out, was just to be in ROTC, and most of my friends were there, and so that was pretty much.
Did you feel like it was you, or was there some point where you said, oh, it's this place? I ask these questions, I like compare other people's experiences to my own, because mm-hmm. it never occurred to me until I was in my 20s, like, oh, maybe it was the place.
Right.
Like, certainly I could have been more curious, I could have been more attentive, I could have had better work habits, but I thought, like, the place was perfect. The place was just unquestionably...
The institution can't be wrong.
Yeah, like, above criticism. I mean, the first time I encountered a question or, like, skepticism about public schools and what they do,
right.
I was in a graduate program in education, mm-hmm. and I stumbled across the work of this guy, John Taylor Gatow, and something called Dumbing Us Down.
Right.
And I said, wow, some people think... You know, school is like some kind of conspiracy against people. Wow, that's fascinating. And then it had nothing to do with whatever brainless research project I was working on. So I closed it, but it planted a seed like, oh, yeah. Yeah, if you did want to control people, or if you did want to manage people or standardize people, where else would you start? I mean, you know, maybe like the state becomes the family that's been tried as well, or takes on, you know, roles that are typically left to the family that's been tried. But other than that, it would be the schools. And it was just something like planted that idea in my head, but I never thought it could be anything wrong with the people who were teaching me. I was, you know, free to not like them and not think they were good people, but they knew what they were doing. I didn't. Everyone else around me seemed to be handling it fine. So the only thing left was there must be some kind of defect in me.
Right. Yeah, I think I sort of had a little bit of both, because I often connected with my teachers on, like, I have several teachers that I had a more personal relationship with. Like, we would talk, and I was always very interested in, like, history and art and music, things like that. So on my own, I would, you know, read a lot. I always read a lot, and a lot of documentaries, things like that. So I was able to talk to adults sometimes easier than other children.
Right.
So they would sometimes tell me, you know, you're really bright or whatever, but my grades never showed it. And I never really felt like I was smart. You know, I never really felt like I was more intelligent or anything. It was always a, well, I just happen to know about this kind of thing. But I did realize that, you know, I wasn't really getting much from what I was being taught in a lot of ways. I wasn't really interested in it. And I did like to learn things, but a lot of times I was just bored in the classroom, or, you know, there were so many things going on outside of school life that everything at school just seemed, you know, and then there were some, you know, bullying and things like that in school that made it just kind of just something to endure. And I did have friends and, you know, lots of, you know, fun activities or whatever, but that was, it was more for social fun was what I saw school as a way to get to see my friends. But I really was never engaged all that much. I did take a marketing class when I was in high school that I loved. And I did really well in my art classes always and of course ROTC, but everything else was just sort of like I had to do it. So mm-hmm. I showed up when I wanted to. I never really did my homework or anything. I just kind of always just managed to get by. So would
you say that it was maybe at times like almost a respite from what was going on outside of school too?
Yes, in a way. My younger years, it was more, I never really focused on school because I was always worried about what was going on at home.
Right.
Like what I was going to come home to and, you know, how I was going to navigate all that. And as I got older, the situation was somewhat better. So yes, it became sort of a respite from trouble at home, but it was still trouble in its own way. I was one of those kids. I always knew I was going to be gone as soon as I hit 18. I was done. I was leaving and I was going to take off. So mm-hmm. that's what I did. But I was always just waiting for that next step, waiting to be independent. That was really my sort of.
It's interesting. That's a unique experience because a lot of people are fearing that, even if they don't know that. Right?
I felt like in a lot of ways I was the parent to my mom. Mm-hmm. So just getting away from that, I knew that I would be able to. I knew I could. If I had endured all the things I had, I felt pretty confident that I could figure out, you know, find my way in life. I mean, I was scared about it, but there was a sense of, you know, freedom that I really looked forward to, you know, independence, making my own choices. So,
absolutely. So being in a kind of situation where you didn't really feel like anyone was doing a good job of being in charge, maybe, is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I think I'd like to try this. Right.
You know. I can't screw it up any worse.
Right.
I mean, I could have. I realize now I could have, but at the time I thought, geez, you know, I pretty much make my own decisions now. So I just can't wait till I can actually do that without, you know, the cops being called on me or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel, how about you?
So, you know, I was always very self-directed. I started out in private school when I was really little in New Orleans, and then we moved to North Carolina, and it was like school took a step back in terms of quality, and at the same time, I was given enough, like, we moved to where my house was right across the street from the library,
mm-hmm.
so I spent the better part of my free time in the library reading whatever I wanted to read, so I was kind of teaching myself at the same time I'm in school, so... Like, for example, I started out and we had the little packets where you'd read a story and then you'd take a test and then you'd move on. And I went through that so quickly that the teacher thought I was just looking at the pictures and, you know, thought that I was learning disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And it took some intervention from my parents and from standardized testing before they realized, no, I was gifted, that I was actually reading those things and that I understood them. And they never interacted with me to find that out.
Wow. Yeah.
But beyond that, it was just – so I got some really fantastic opportunities because that school happened to have money for the gifted program that was really kind of – it was like a bubble inside the school. So I took regular classes with everybody else, but they would take us out of class and we'd spend 2 hours a day in the gifted class with other kids. And in that time frame, we would do research projects or we would talk about things that we really liked. And it was kind of just like an incubator for advanced thought in – just your bone stock elementary school in a small town in North Carolina. So I was learning how to write argumentative papers in fourth grade. I was learning how to accept the fact that, you know, when I knew the answer to a math problem, that I really didn't need to be able to put that, my method on how I got there. I didn't have to prove that it was done by the method they were teaching.
Right.
That it was okay that I could look at a problem and I could give them the answer.
Mm-hmm.
That they accepted that. They let me do things like answer the first problem and the last problem in a homework set, and that was good enough. So I didn't get beaten into some of the molds that other kids did. And then, so my dad was a doctor, and so I had some other opportunities afforded me that other kids in the area didn't. Like the local college had a youth learning program in the summers. Where one summer I went and I learned, it was a week of computer programming, and then a week of television studio production, and a week of science fiction. And I didn't know it at the time, but that week of computer programming was kind of key.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't end up being a computer programmer, but what I did end up doing at the time was I turned into a hacker. And I wanted to know everything there was to know about computers. And I understood that a computer was not the thing that your parents would buy you and you would hook to your television, but it was something bigger that you could get access to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used that thing my parents got me as a way to connect to the computer. And so I was using the college computer and I was just learning. And then one day I get a message and it was so-and-so wants to talk. And so I, you know, had a conversation with them.
And what year is this?
I was 12. So 1982.
Okay.
And so-and-so wants to talk. I'm talking to them and he's like, how did you get here? And I was like, well, I took the summer program and I knew the pattern you used for your accounts. And so I guessed and I got in and here I am. And they're like, wow, would you like to have a job? And so, you know, in the course of the next few years, I ended up being the person responsible for their computer system. A couple years passed, I stopped doing that so much, and I went back to being a regular student. But then I get to college, and I'm taking computer science classes, and I'm really excelling at them. But I'm also kind of a troublemaker and kind of my own, directed in my own ways. And a friend of mine is like, hey, I'm quitting this job, and they need somebody, and I think you can do it. So I got to detach from the school process and end up at the very front end of the tech boom.
So I'm listening to your story, and I'm like, you know, I've also heard you describe your attitudes towards public schooling generally, and I'm thinking, you know, you have this experience with these opportunities going through school. You're offered a job before you're even done with college. When did you ever realize that school wasn't totally rad, you know, for most people? Because, I mean, it sounds like you had a pretty positive experience,
well,
right?
Well, so the regular class time was always just incredibly boring. I was disconnected. I was bored. I was an underperformer. They mm-hmm. were, like, they could convince me through various tricks to do well for a single marking period, but it was never something that I felt like had any value to me. I didn't see significantly more value to an A than a C.
Mm-hmm.
Because either way, I wasn't learning anything. It was just a letter.
Yeah.
So I spent my time learning the things that I was interested in. I would, you know, I read every book in the library. I knew how to do math beyond any level they were teaching in school. I could work with computers and program them. So I was, you know, my goal was really to was the next level, and school was just something I had to sit through.
Right.
So it really was, it was almost torture for me to be in school, to the point where when I was in middle school, one year, my teacher was like, well, if you get an A on this next marking period, I'll give you an hour a week where you don't have to be in the classroom. You can just go and do your own thing on school property. And so I did that, and that was the most valuable time I had, because I was just hanging out in the grass and watching the clouds go by and not being yelled at for not paying attention.
So how was it socially being in that situation where you're kind of going back and forth between doing your own thing and having to be basically mainstreamed into these classes? I mean, did you feel like you were, you know, out of place?
All of my friends were adults.
Yeah.
My whole life, from when I was 3 or 4 years old, all of my friends were adults. I never really had a peer group until I was in the computer science department in college.
Were there consequences to that socially? You know,
I got beat up as a kid. I ended up, I went through all of the things you would expect a nerdy kid would go through in a sports-oriented town in Western North Carolina. I mean, I played football and I got crushed. Mm-hmm. And I would show up at school and I would get beaten up. And then I would, you know, I would cry and say a curse word. Then I would get beaten up and punished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would, you know, I went through all of the social ostracism that happens. I didn't really learn how to socialize myself until I figured out that you could just put on being social as a role and act.
Yeah.
And so I would pretend to be a social person, and then I finally actually learned how to become a social person.
Right. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I didn't really get anything out of school. It was all, I mean, I was unschooled and then forced to go to school is what it amounts to.
Right.
Well, those are three different stories. And I wanted to end with one just open-ended question. Anyone and or everyone can answer. When we express criticisms about, you know, economic policy, politics generally, or public schooling, what comes back at us, I think we've all had the experience, but what would you do? You know, how would you solve this problem? So I'm wondering if you guys have ever encountered that when it comes to school and how you answered that, if you got that question.
Well, the one particular question that I get most often is, what about socialization? That's mm-hmm. the one I hear most about my kids, and they socialize fine. I mean, my son, who's older, is just kind of a shy person, so a lot of people take that as he's, you know, backwards or something. My daughter is super outgoing. But my son knows a lot of the adults in the neighborhood. He has friends his own age. He makes friends with adults very easily and sometimes with his peer group. So I just look at, you know, multi-generational friendships, and I think it's more natural. I mean, that's, you know, public school has been around, what, a couple hundred years at the most?
Yeah,
so
about that.
What did people do for the thousands of years beforehand? Like they just lived in their communities and in their families. So that's what I encourage. I'm a part of a local, you know, group that we do things, and I take my kids along and they meet those people. And so I just try to have them live life with me and meet whoever. And that's, they've done fine.
I really like that answer. John Taylor Gatto, who I was telling you guys about when we were eating, and you were familiar, you weren't, right? John Taylor Gatto was a teacher in New York for about 30 years, and he worked in the inner city with kids who were, you know, economically disadvantaged. And he said, you know, these kids, middle school, they're going to need to learn to be self-sufficient. You know, they're coming from situations where, you know, they don't get a lot of support at home. They're not going to, you know, in many cases, they're not going to have a path to, you know, Princeton or Harvard, or even if they did academically, they might not be able to take advantage of it. So they need to learn how to be confident and independent. And what he would do, I mean, he would be arrested if he was teaching today. He would find adults in the community that he trusted, that he had relationships with, and he would pair them up. He would say, okay, you two are going to go with Bill on his truck driving route and, you know, come back and tell me what you learn. Or he would send them out there with, you know, a purpose. And he would do this all the time, putting kids and adults together against, you know, the rules of the school. He was sneaking kids out of his own classroom into the world. You know, it's an amazing story. But that sounds like that was your experience as well. You knew that the best opportunities were not with people who were exactly your same, or born within 9 months of you, you know?
And the sad thing is that now a lot of, like, instead of giving these children in the inner city situation with, you know, a lot less opportunity in a lot of ways, that opportunity to learn skills and to be hooked up with an adult who can teach them those things, now it would be maybe considered racist to do that because you're saying that's all these kids can do, or, mm-hmm. you know, they've limited so much around the politics of things rather than what's actually best for children.
Well, everything's political now. I mean, everything that you can no longer have a conversation about anything without politics coming up.
Or political correctness in many cases too, which is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I was just reading an article where they were talking about the Horace Mann and this, you know, the public schooling movement, mm-hmm. and how that was absolutely marketed as a way to get, what had happened was the Irish Catholics had moved en masse into the country, and of course, Protestant America didn't really like that much. So it was a way to teach them what they wanted them to be socially. So from the beginning, it sort of has had its roots in this idea that school is to teach children how to be what we want socially, not mm-hmm. how to actually learn things, you know, that would be beneficial to their lives individually for their own, you know, things that they enjoy, but to make them more uniform and homogenous.
Right. Horace Mann was kind of a proto-progressive.
Right.
The progressives that showed up in the 1920s that were very totalitarian, and they're sort of reemerging in academia today in the last 10 years. And what they wanted to do, I mean, even though, you know, a reform movement comes 50 years after Horace Mann begins his work, you know, spearheaded by people like John Dewey, the common goal was to produce self-regulating individuals, that they would put the police, you know, in that person's head. You know, the way they wanted to police people, they would use the pedagogy to get them to police themselves. You know, they would internalize the control. And I think that that was certainly, I mean, to humanize these people, because it's so easy to turn this into, like, you know, a conspiracy theory or good versus evil. They wanted to control people and, you know, they had all these plans. Irish Catholic immigrants were insane compared to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who were established in this country. Irish immigrants would get jobs building a bridge, and they would drink all day, and if they wouldn't be paid, they would blow up the bridge. There's stories about this in Renegade History of the United States by Thaddeus Russell.
Yeah, sounds like you have to read that book. It's amazing.
They were doing all of these things that were like Irish people. They would merge by class, right? So the Irish would hang out with black people in the inner city, you know, and this was like unheard of. I mean, there was debates into the 1900s about whether or not black people, Irish people, and Nordic people were even the same species.
Right.
They would rank people who appeared to be white. You know, you have the Nordics, and then they're the best. And then you have the Alpines, and they're like the Italians. Like, they're okay. You know, they look like us, but they're kind of getting closer to this part of the world where people aren't as good, you know? So it's a hard time to understand. And it's very easy to cast a lot of those people as evil, like man. And, I mean, Dewey is just such a good example of the road to hell being paved with good intentions. But also, you know, being sheltered from the realities of the world in academia, developing a fanciful vision of what you want the world to be without ever seeing what the world is like, you know. And that's still going on today. So I forget how I got off on that, but
mentioned Horace Mann.
That's all it takes.
Even going back to what you were saying earlier about the individual and having the individual be at the core of everything, I feel like no one is talking about the individual ever.
No,
it's always no one.
So direct. I mean, even now, like, even libertarians are splitting off into identity movements, opposing identity movements, you know? And I think that there is some idealism in individualism, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we are part of groups. We are a tribal being. That's important to remember. I want to treat everybody like an individual. I want to, you know, value everyone's individuality. But I'm in a minority. Most people see me as part of a group.
Right.
Yeah.
Apparently a dangerous, oppressive one.
White cis.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
How dare you?
I have the opposite. Like, a lot of times I feel like, because I hang around a bunch of anarchists, that people talk about the individual a lot, but they don't talk about how in an anarchist society, we will need community. Like, we're not going to get by without that community. So we're individuals, and we all own ourselves completely.
Mm.
But we have to make these, you know, allowances for the fact that community is what's going to help people who are in the, like, those are the things that are going in an anarchist type society. Like, my family grew up very rural. You know, that's the people I come from, you know, my people. And that's what they did for each other. They were farmers and, you know, picked cotton and things like that. But when someone was sick, they went and took them food. They made sure things were done for them. Like, you need that community as well. So there's this aspect of community that we need to have, but not collectivism. And I think that's a really important distinction that people often, I see people tend to miss that a lot. Well, I'm an anarchist and I'm an individual. And,
Well, yes, you are, but you don't live alone.
And you, that's not how you were meant to live. Your biology doesn't lend itself to that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we've had panels at the Porcupine Freedom Festival that were basically called "The Non-Aggression Principle Does Not Mean You Can Be an Asshole." they were basically called that, right? But people are seeking a kind of safety in these ideas too, right? I say these things, I'm part of the group. It's in us. It's biological. If you didn't want to be part of the group, You know, as we developed, then you were this other thing called food. So I really believe that it's built into us, and it's something that we have to, you know, question and live consciously about.
Have you heard of Jonathan Haidt?
Oh, yeah, sure.
The Righteous Mind.
The Righteous Mind,
it's one of my favorite. I've read that book 3 or 4 times. And in that, he talks about, you know, the hive mind. And it, being a science fiction lover, I think of the Borg, like this collective of people that, you know, are just automatons. Mm-hmm. But really, they're that hive switch in our brains. Like, we need that. That's part of that community that we need. That's why, you know, going to a concert feels so good, or a sporting event where you're all kind of in the same thing. So there's that distinction between needing other people. You know, being an individualist doesn't mean you don't need anyone else. And it doesn't mean that other people don't matter. It's just that who has most agency in your life, and that should be you.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a really, really
and so you know, it's radical freedom, but it's also radical personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I think in our society we've gotten to this point where we want to teach people to be responsible, but sort of also from the top down, like from outside influence. We're going to put them in jail to make them more responsible, like to correct them. But it never works that way. You give people responsibility, and that's how they become responsible, just raising children. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to do that. So it's sort of that same thing that, you know, we have to recognize that we do live in a community, but we're not a collective. We're a community made up of individuals, and many of us have similar interests, likes, desires, whatever. But that doesn't put us in a collective where we can speak for one another and make decisions based on that. But it's tricky. It's nuanced. It's not so clear as...
Well, that's the problem with it, because in this day and age, everything is, are you on my side or not? Yes or no? Check this box. Be, you know, if you say a phrase, then I automatically put you in a box, and I can either conversate with you or disregard you. Yeah. And that's just kind of where everybody is now. And it's so sad.
I think it's kind of always been that way, though. I think
maybe
it's heightened right now because the pendulum swings back and forth between ultra-authoritarianism and ultra-authoritarianism, just on a different spectrum. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think that most people in general just try and be normal and try and go down the middle of the road. But, you know, there are things that get heightened in society every once in a while, and the, you know, the ultra authoritarian left pops up a lot, and then it swings back, and it's the ultra authoritarian right.
Right.
Well, it's politics too. I mean, I think like outside of the world of, like, if you don't check your Facebook news feed for a month, like I pretty much haven't, the world seems like a pretty decent place to live. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, you do have to be cautious out there, but most people are pretty nice, and you know, there's a lot to talk about with a person before you get to politics. But politics is that arena where humans can feel sophisticated in acting out their worst impulses,
right?
It is like a sophisticated way of just showcasing the worst features of humanity.
I can steal from you because I use a proxy. It's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in that arena, we see a lot of ugly things, and I think it's important to check in and see what's going on there, but also to live outside of it. You said, Carrie, that like more and more things are becoming political. 3 years ago, I could have bought a 24-ounce soda in New York City without it being a political conversation. You know, 15 years ago, I could have talked about going on a trip on an airplane without it being a political conversation. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, I could talk about healthcare issues without it being a political conversation. The longer government goes on, the more things become political conversations, you know, because the more it reaches out into things. But anyway, unless there's any burning desires, I want to thank you guys for participating in this conversation. This was really awesome. This was a nice, intimate gathering tonight. I really enjoyed it. And I like it when, you know, it's cool when 20 people show up someplace, but it's also nice when you can have a connected conversation at a table, awkwardly arranged, but it worked. So, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The road.